رحم الله من قرأ سورة الفاتحة. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي بعدا فلا يرى وقربا فشهد النجوى تبارك وتعالى والصلاة والسلام على سيد الأنبياء وخاتم المرسلين والشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا بالقاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين الذين أذهب الله عنهم الرجس وطهرهم تطهيرا. واللعنة الدائمة الباقية لأعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم بغاصب حقوقهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه الكريم: إن الدين عند الله الإسلام. صلوات الله عليه وسلم. With the blessings of the Azaf, Sayyid al-Shuhada and his family members and the companions of Karbala, we have this opportunity of not only gathering to mourn and grieve the tragedy of Karbala, but we also get the opportunity to sit down and reflect about ourselves, our history, our religion. And this is a way of trying to reestablish our bay'at with the Imam of the time, who is the Waris of Hussein. The theme that I have been talking on this during these Ashara Majalis is the theme of Islam in modernity, where the attempt has been to answer this question that how can Islam, which came 1400 years ago in the Arabian Peninsula, be a relevant religion for us in this part of the world, in this stage of human history? And the answer, as I have said, can be summarized in one sentence: that Islam has these elements of continuity as well as the elements of change within itself. And if we are able to identify both these elements of continuity and change within Islam, Islam will never become obsolete for us, it will never become outdated for us, and it will always be relevant to our lives. There are three areas that I started the discussion. One was the area of i'tiqadat, you know, the aqidah and the belief system. And there we made it very clear. When it comes to the aqidah, there is absolutely no room for change there. This is an element of continuity which will go on till the end of Qiyamah. When we look at the second area of our discussion, where we looked at ibadat, the system of rituals, that's where we saw the interaction between the element of continuity as well as change, where continuity is more and change is there, but to a lesser degree. But the main focus of our discussion from the last two nights, and inshallah the remaining nights that we have, is on the third area, which has to do with mu'amalat. And by that I mean the lifestyle and the culture that we live within that. This is where we see the elements of continuity and change go hand in hand. Both are at equal force. Last night we basically looked at the example, because if you remember, before that we just started a discussion of the concept of migration and hijrah. That's how Islam spread from Arabian Peninsula to different parts of the world, where people of different language, culture, background have come into the fold of Islam. then Islam, being a world religion, has been able to manifest in different cultural backgrounds, and that's where you see this element of continuity and change. Last night, my talk was mostly, you know, dealing with this segment of the community, which is more on one extreme, whom I call the traditionalists. We looked at the example of hijab. Hijab was not the topic of my majlis last night. It was just being used as a very obvious and powerful example of what I call continuity and change. Because when you look at the basic principle of modesty and decency in dress, this is a constant value in Islam which will never change. The concept of haya, the concept of iffat, the concept of modesty and decency in dress as well as, you know, interaction of people of opposite genders, this will be their part of the Islamic teachings forever. It will never change. But then you look at the same ayat of Quran from Surah Nur and Surah Ahzab as we looked at it last night. Muslim women, practicing Muslim women in different parts of the world, implemented those ayat in different forms according to their own cultural background. So you have the abaya of the Arabs, chador of the Iranians, you have Afghanistan and in South Asia, you have niqab and parda. You go to Indonesia, it's a different form of hijab. You go to East Africa, it's buibui. You come to the western part of the world, what is now known as hijab. And so you have this, you know, constant value of Islam being practiced by practicing Muslim women around the world, but it manifests in different forms. As long as the requirements of Sharia are fulfilled, all this diversity of the forms of hijab that you see are equally Islamic. We ended with the example of the days of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, where we saw that, you know, there is a constant value known as Muwasat as far as the leaders are concerned. The days of Ali and Rasul, the days of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, there was difference there. The difference was not in the core values. The difference was according to the Zaman and Makan. You know, both at their own time used the material for themselves, for dress, which was according to the common standard of the society of that time. Since the days of the Prophet, Muslims were mostly going through difficult economic situations. The Prophet and Rasul and Imam Ali basically lived a very simple life. But by the days of the sixth Imam, the economic condition and the standard of living of Muslims had gone up. This is where you see the sixth Imam allows himself to wear, you know, the dress of a better quality. So there is no contradiction there. They are still following the same concept of Muwasat, but it depends on the time and the place that you find yourself. Salawat Pandey Ekbaram. Tonight I would like to go to the other side of the, you know, discussion and deal with the modernists. And I hope everybody will not, nobody will take this personal. You know, that's my whole purpose of coming on the minbar. I have to say things not everybody would like. You know, but that's my responsibility. Tonight we'll talk about this whole concept of modernity. What does it mean? And when we talk about this issue that we have moved to this part of the world, you know, the challenges that we face in implementing Islam in the Western society. Normally we have two kinds of problems. You see, one is that if we lived in our own, you know, homelands, whether it's East Africa or India or Pakistan or Iran or Iraq, you know, you were confined to your own cultural background. People spoke same language, came from the same cultural background, you know, and you used to do things in the way that everyone else does. Then you leave that environment and you come to the western part of the world. And that's where you see the culture is completely, the cultural background has changed completely. If you look at Islam, that it can only be practiced the way it was practiced in your homeland, then you will have difficulty in practicing Islam in this new cultural background. This is where it becomes very important for us to behave, you know, to have this ability to distinguish what is the constant element of Islam as far as the values are concerned in the, from the cultural and lifestyle point of view, and what are the changing elements which are allowed by the Sharia itself. The second problem that we see here is that, you know, if you lived in your own homeland, you only dealt with one culture. Now you come to New York. You go to Al-Foy Center, you will see majalis in different languages, people of different cultures going there. You come from a different background, you know, do things in a different way. You go to another center, you will see people who are coming from Iranian background, they do things in a different way. All of them are following Shia Islam. They believe in the same deen and madhab. But their cultural, you know, lifestyle is different from one another. And sometimes there is conflict. And that's where we start saying, oh, are we doing right or are they wrong? Many times we say we are right and they are wrong. And I'll give you one example. Those who come from South Asian background, whether they are from East Africa or India or Pakistan, you know, our culture there is that to smoke in presence of elders is considered to be a sign of disrespect. You know, sometimes I see outside the masajid, people are smoking as soon as they see, oh, Maulana is coming. The cigarette is hidden, but the smoke is coming out. You know, so that's the culture, and there's nothing wrong with it. And now go and say, you go to India and Pakistan, for example, or even East Africa, and there smoke inside Imam Bala or a masjid. You will be thrown out very rudely. You go to Iran, I don't know now it's still practiced or not, but before, you know, pre-revolutionary era, when they have Majlis-e-Tarheem is the Majlis for Fatihani, you know, for the Marhumin. And there the tradition is that the Quran Khan is going on, the Qari of Quran is reciting the Quran. Later on, the Maulana will go to recite a short majlis. People come in, sit down, they get the juz of the Quran to do the Quran Khani. And you will see, after every fifth person, there will be ashtray with four or five cigarettes and a matchbox. Right where, when the Quran Khani is going on, inside the masjid or the mambara, those who are smokers, they smoke. Providing cigarette and matchbox in Majlis-e-Tarheem, in Iranian culture, was part of hospitality. If you don't do that, they will say you're not a good mehman nawaz. And so this is where you see, you know, sometimes cultures are very different. You look at one thing in one culture, it is acceptable, in another it's not. And so this is where when we come here and we see a multicultural Shia community. Although they are still part, you know, because of their language and culture, they do things separately, but a time will come. Three, four generations after now, you know, they will be Shia Isnashari from America. There will be no more Khoja or Indian or Pakistan or Iran or Iraqi. They will be American. And so this is where we have to realize that, you know, there would be some issues and you can only resolve those kind of problems if you know what are the core values of Islam as far as the culture and the lifestyle is concerned, which are constant values which will never change. And what are the elements which depend on Zaman and Makan, and that can change according to, within the limits of the Sharia law. Salawat parna hai para. And so what is to be done? We see two extremes. You know, we have the rigid traditionalist on one side who would like to practice their religion totally and exactly the way it was done back home. And I'm not saying it's wrong. What I'm saying is that they would, you know, they have to accept the reality. You're no more in back home. you are here in North America. Things cannot be done exactly in the same way the way it was done back home. On the other hand, you know, we have some people whom basically I call naive progressivists or ignorant modernists, whose criteria is that whatever is modern is automatically right, and whatever is traditional, we have to abandon that. And we have a problem with both extremes. But tonight we will deal with the second one. The solution is very simple, that we have to realize that there has to be a balance between what is known as traditionalism and what is known as modernism. Only then you will be able to bring about a healthy mixture of the traditional values in a modern setting of the Western society. Salawat alaikum barakatuh. First of all, we have to understand what is modernity. What do we mean by this? Because if you look at the term modernity, something is modern. The problem is this term itself is relative. What was modern 20 years ago is now obsolete. What is modern now, after 10 years, it will become outdated. So we have a problem with this whole, you know, phenomenon of modernity, because it is not static. It itself is a relative issue. If you study the social scientists, now they talk about postmodernism. So we are even moved away from this era of modernism. We are in postmodernism. I don't know what they are going to say after 20 years. Postmodernism? So there's a problem with this whole concept itself. It is a very relative, you know, concept. And this is where we have to see that those who are modernists, they say, we have to move with the time. Zamane ke saath chalo. It seems to be a very noble idea. But if you really think about it, philosophically there is a problem in even understanding this philosophy, that to move with time, what does it mean? And this is where I would like to go to one of the great scholars of the century, of the Shia world, Shahid Murtaza Mutahhiri. You know, in one of his books he says, what is strange about the so-called modernist is that the criteria of accepting or rejecting something is nothing except it's being new or old. If it is new, we accept it. If it's old and traditional, we reject it. And then he gives an example. He says, to exploit women, according to the naive progressivist, is bad because the world today no longer approves of it. But if we lived at a time when it was okay to exploit women, it would have been okay, because they go with the time. You know, that is what it means, you go with the time. You know, just less than 100 years ago, right in the United States of America, when it came to the issue of the right of inheritance or even the right of ownership or to manage the wealth which was inherited, let's say, by the woman, was a problem. It had to be managed by the husband or the father. It's only during the interwar period, when the industry wanted workers in their factories, now that the young men have gone to war, there was no incentive for women to come and work, because whatever they earn will be only managed by the father or the husband. And that is where the laws were changed, to give total right to the woman for whatever she earns. Even in Canada, for example, in 1930s, this issue came out, that they used to have elections, and only men were allowed to vote. Why? Because their bylaws said that the voting right is exclusively for persons. Persons, P-E-R-S-O-N-S. And in their definition, women were not persons. Basically, women were not humans, like men. Until this issue went to, those days, you know, Canada was a colony of England. It went to London there. There it was resolved that, okay, women also can be classified under persons. Therefore, they have a right to vote in the election. And so when we look at this system, this is what Mursal Mutahhir is saying, that, you know, those who believe about this issue of new and old, and their criteria is only this: whatever is modern is right and whatever is traditional and old is wrong, they actually don't really have a solid, you know, principled way of looking at things. You know, I don't have that much time really to compare this with the Islamic perspective, but I'll just give you one ayat. Islam, 1400 years ago, when it came to the humanity of women, this was not an issue of discussion at all, because it was taken for granted that women were as human as men. In Christian theology, till about 200 years ago, they had a discussion whether black people and women have souls or not. So even their humanity was not really acknowledged. But in Islam, from day one, this was never an issue at all. There is not a single discussion that I have seen in theological books of the early days or the present day where this becomes an issue, because it was taken for granted. The worth of a work done by a male or a female, Quran mostly uses masculine style of speech. But on this matter, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in a way goes out of his way to make it clear, وَمَنْ عَمِلَ صَالِحًا مِنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى, that whoever does good deeds, whether a male or a female, Allah clarifies this issue. The worth of their good deed will not go waste. They will be rewarded for it. And so when you look at this issue, you have to realize that, you know, this issue about moving with time, what are you talking about? Think about it more. It might seem very fancy and trendy, you know, way of saying, yeah, we move with time. But think about it. What are you saying? Salawat on Iqbal Khawi. Now, I quoted Murtaza Mutahhiri. You will say, well, he was a mullah with Aba Qaba and Amama, so we don't expect him to say anything but what you quoted. Let me quote to you somebody who is a professor at the university in your own country, from the Islamic background. And this is Dr. Hussain Nasr, who teaches Islam at George Washington University in D.C. And in one of his books, he actually talks about the same theme in almost in the same way. And so you have the mullah and an intellectual giving you the same message on this issue. Dr. Nasr says, these days we are often told that we must keep up with the times. Rarely does one ask, what have the times to keep up with? You know, as Mutahhiri says, you have to go with the time. But what is the criteria of this time itself? And then he says, Dr. Nasr, for men who have lost the vision of a reality which transcends time, who are caught completely in the mess of our time and space, and who have been affected by historicism prevalent in modern European philosophy, it is difficult to imagine the validity of a truth that does not conform to their immediate external environment. Islam, however, is based on the principle that truth transcends history and time. Divine law is an objective transcendent reality by which man and his actions are judged, and not vice versa. What are called the times today are to a large extent a set of problems and difficulties created by man's ignorance of his own real nature and his stubborn determination to live by bread alone. To attempt to shape the divine law to the times is therefore no less than spiritual suicide. I really like his description here. Try to fit Islam according to the times all the time. This is spiritual suicide. Today an idea would be current, so you go and fit things about Islam, okay, bring it to this current view. After 20 years, that current idea will become obsolete. The modern world will come with another idea. Again, you go back to Islam and try to fit it again to bring it in line with what is current at that time. So basically you are just playing with your religion. You do not believe then that Islam has something concrete to guide us at all times and for all places. Salawat upon the Akbar. And this attitude is not, you know, those who say we just have to go with the time. And that is how we are going to progress. This is something not new. If you study the modern history of Middle East, you will see in 1930s, there was a group of intellectuals emerged in Egypt. People like Dr. Taha Hussein and others, who actually were strongly believed in and promoted this idea that in order for us to progress, we must imitate the West completely, in its good as well as in its bad. Everything that they do in their customs, their manners, their traditions, their civil and social laws, we must conform our society to the West. Only then we will have progress in our societies. Alhamdulillah, the idea didn't work. But you had people in the Muslim world who were thinking in this way. Then you have the example of Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, who is actually a pure 100% secularist. And he basically believed that for Turkey to progress, you know, we must completely imitate the Western norm. And so what does he do? You know, just by one decree that he had as the president of the time, he basically ordered the Turkish people to change their attire. To change from the Turkish clothes to put on the Western clothes. And they thought, you know, that by doing this, progress will come automatically. And this is where we have to realize that, you know, modernity in that sense really has no concrete ground for progress. And look at Turkey today. Today even the Muslims there are suffering because of the attitude of Ataturk. He not only changed their attire, he even changed their script of the language. Turkish before him was written in Arabic alphabets. But after him it's written in Latin language. So he basically is cutting off the historical roots of the modern people of Turkey from their historical background completely. And even now, you see, you know, they wanted to become member of the European Union. They have not yet been wholeheartedly accepted. So you lost everything, your background, your culture, your language, your historical roots, and the West has not yet accepted you wholeheartedly. So you lost your own things and you didn't gain what you were looking for. Salawat upon the Akbar. You know, this reminds me of a story when the Europeans went to West Africa. Part of the explorers who went there, one of them was a European blonde guy, a doctor. The son of the chief became ill. And the, witch doctor did everything, didn't work. So then this European doctor basically cured him with medicine. Now the chief thought that this is because of his blonde hair. You know what's happened to him? He ordered his people to pulk out every hair from his head and transplant that on the, you know, glue it on the witch doctor's head. Because he thought that his healing power comes from this hair. And this is where, you know, it's not the issue of imitating West outwardly is going to make you advance further. You have to look at the concrete issues of what is progress, what is advancement. And we'll talk about it, the issue of education, science and technology, inshallah, maybe on Monday night. And this is where we see that we cannot go by this attitude of whatever is modern and new is okay, and whatever is traditional old is to be abandoned. No. We have to look at everything individually, specifically, and then make a wise decision whether we want to maintain this tradition or we would like to modify it. Salawat from the Akbar. Going back to Murtaza Mutahhiri, he makes a very good comment where he says, one should advance with the progress of time, but also struggle against the decomposition and deviance of time. Because the zaman that you are talking about doesn't have everything good. It has good and bad. And so you should take the good part of it and abandon the bad part of it, especially when you talk about moral values of the modern society in the West. He goes on to say one should look to see from which origins new phenomena and changes arise forth, and in what direction they flow. Does the change arise from higher human drives or from his lower animal desires? Man can step abroad the vehicle of time and change, but he should not neglect the steering and control of that vehicle even for a moment. Those who talk much about changes of time and neglect to steer and control it have forgotten the role of the man himself in the transformation of his lifestyle, and are like the rider of a horse who has put himself under the control of the horse. And so my brothers and sisters, when we talk about modernity, when we talk about this attitude that whatever is modern is automatically right, no, that is not what Islam is saying. We realize that as Muslims, you know, a Muslim is not bound by time. He should actually control the time. A Muslim is not slave of the time. He is the slave of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And a Muslim does not sit as a passenger in the vehicle of change. He is in the driver's seat, directing the vehicle in the right direction of submission to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salawat pranik para Allah. You know, this brings me to this whole question, that when we talk about change, what should be changed? Because there's a lot of confusion even among Muslim intellectuals here in the West. Yes, there is a need for change, but change what? What is the objective of change, or islah, or reform? We talk about islah, which means, you know, to bring about reformation. What do you want to change? There is an opinion now, very strongly being promoted to the, over the Muslims, by the centers of power in the Western countries, as well as the academia linked to them, where there is a saying that, you know, there is a need for Islam to be changed. There is a need for Islam to be reformed. I've heard even some Shia intellectuals talking about it. They say, look at the Jewish community in North America. You have the conservative, the orthodox, and then you have the Reformed Judaism. And they say, a time will come, we will also have same, you know, orthodox Islam and conservative Islam and Reformed Islam. So already the talk is out there. And my point is that we do not deny that there is a need for change according to the time and space that we are here. But the bigger question is, what is to be changed? Is it the religion which has to be changed? Or is it the ummah which has to be changed? Islah and reformation. Do you reform the religion of Islam? Or do you reform the ummah of Islam? And there's a very delicate difference there. We are not talking about reformation of Islam. There is no need to reform our deen. There is need to reform our ummah, to bring the ummah on the wise footing according to the teachings of Islam, according to our own time. Salawat. You look at the words of Imam Hussain alayhi salam when he left Medina. He wrote a will and left it with Muhammad Hanafiya. And that's where we get this guidance. What is to be reformed? Is it the ummah or the deen? Right in the beginning, Imam Hussain alayhi salam writes that, إِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لِطَلَبِ الْإِسْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي. He says, I have risen against Yazid for only one purpose. لِطَلَبِ الْإِسْلَاحِ, to seek reformation. Reformation of what? لِطَلَبِ الْإِسْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي. In order to reform the community of my grandfather. He doesn't say to reform the deen of my jad. And so what is to be reformed and changed is not our religion. What is to be reformed is the ummah, to bring them closer to the teachings of Islam and the Shiaism of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. Salawat alaykum. And also when we talk about change, yes, there are things that we have to change. But change for what? We have to change the attitude of the ummah, the behavior of the ummah, you know, the akhlaq of the ummah, not change the religion of Islam. Similarly, even when we talk about change, for what? Is it to please the others? Or we do that for the sake of pleasing Allah and Rasul and the Imam of the time? Because if you want to please others, they will never be pleased. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala told the Prophet, لَن تَرْضَ عَنْكَ الْيَهُودُ وَالنَّصَارَ حَتَّى تَطَّبِعَ مِلَّتُهُمْ. And it's addressed directly to Rasulullah. That, O Muhammad, لَن means never ever. The Yahud and Nasara will never be pleased with you until you follow their religion. So if we are changing our own ways, our own traditions, our own cultural values, because we live in this part of the world, if we are doing it to please others, nothing will happen. You will never get that total satisfaction from the other. And so what you should target is actually to see the change I'm bringing about. Does it please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or not? Does it please Rasulullah or not? Does it please the Imam of our time, Hazrat Mahdi ajallallahu ta'ala faraju sharif Allah? Salawat alaykum. I didn't see the time, what time I was sitting, but anyway, it's Saturday night, I don't have to worry about it. Salawat alaykum. See, when we talk about moving forward and bringing about changes, and I said there are elements of continuity and change in our religion, and we have to identify those two elements so that when we make the decision, we are doing it in the right way. And this is where we have to really do one thing which we have not been doing. For us to establish our next generation on a solid footing in this part of the world, we need to study the culture of this society. We don't really do much. Yes, we have doctors, we have engineers, we have IT people. Do we have people who have gone into social sciences to study the whole, you know, North American system, how it works? Or with the psychology of this culture and people? No, we don't go into that. And this is where we really have to look at this culture to understand what is right, what is wrong, what we can accept from it, what we have to reject. What are the good things in it that we can take in, and what are the bad things that we have to keep our next generation away from it? And this is where I'll just, you know, there are three elements that we need to really talk about it. And I'll discuss only one tonight, and we'll leave the other two things for tomorrow night. When it comes to what is known as modernity, one of the obvious signs of modern culture here in the West is rebellion against tradition. Starting from the time of the hippies, you know, 60s, this is the modern culture, where these people used to do things just to rebel against the tradition of their forefathers, not because those traditions were wrong. That became part of the modern culture. Of course, the extreme has gone down, but the attitude is still there. And this is where we have to see that, you know, just because their ancestors, they used to do things, they say, we don't want to do this. We'll do the other way. And this is sometimes, you know, described as what is known as generation gap. As far as the immigrant Muslims are concerned, That generation gap happens why? When we in the Western society do not give enough time to our family and our children. I know this, you know, the pace of life here is very fast. If you don't put in extra hours, you'll not be able to maintain that high standard of living that you want for your children. But my question is, all the struggling you are doing, extra hours you are putting in, which is taking you away from your family life and your children's life, what will happen at the end? They will have the best of education. But because of that gap, what is known as a generation gap, at the end, the same children that you struggled everything and sacrificed everything for them, when you become old, you will end up in the old house alone. If you have to make a choice on the standard of living, maybe a lesser standard, where you are able to give time to your family. This is so important. Let me go to the hadith of Imam Musa al-Kazim, alayhi salatu wasalam. Where Imam says you have to divide your time into four segments. One for your ibadah with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which doesn't take that much. You know, the minimum requirement would only ask you for 35 minutes out of 24 hours. So it's not really asking much. And then the second segment, Imam says, lil ma'ash, you have to, you know, spend your time for seeking livelihood for yourself and your family. And then the third segment for your community, you know, to socialize with the community. And the fourth segment, Imam says, for your family life. What is amazing, and really this hadith seems to be applicable for us during our time, where the seventh Imam says that the fourth segment is the key to success. He says all three other segments will only be there in its place if you fulfill the fourth one. Family time here has to be scheduled. Take that as a wajib for you in this part of the world. In the Eastern society, this is where we do not, you know, look at the differences. There you are not alone. You have your relatives, extended family around in the same city. And even if you didn't have your relatives and extended, you know, relatives, family members, you had neighbors who watch out for one another. You would not be worried about your child going to the neighborhood park. Can you do that here? Yes? Very rare, maybe. You know? You will be worried all the time. If you go there, you know, in the Eastern society, you have this social network where people take care of one another. We took it for granted. And now only when you think about it, you miss that here. If your young child goes out and smokes and you don't know about it, if the convenience store guy saw him, be sure that the father would be informed by the night time. Huh? And so the whole society was there. Here, there is nothing there. And this is where it becomes religiously obligatory for parents. And I see many young parents here. Take it as a religious duty to have, you know, specific time on a daily basis and weekly basis for your family. This is where you'll be able to maintain that, you know, link, and the gap would not be there. And this is how you'll be able to inculcate the religious values as well as the good cultural values that we have for the next generation. Salaam alaikum. Let me end with one hadith. Unfortunately, this whole issue of what is known as generation gap is sometimes even promoted by some of our new speakers, especially those who are the English language speakers, where they say that, well, you know, the times have changed. And they say there is a hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen where he says, do not raise your child according to the customs of your own time. And they quote a hadith which says, لا تقصروا أولادكم على آدابكم. Do not compel your children on your norms or your customs. فَإِنَّهُمْ مَخْلُوقُونَ لِزَمَانٍ غَيْرَ زَمَانِكُمْ. Because they have been created for a time which is different from your time. Very progressive idea. And you say, and if you attribute that to Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, what else do you want? And this is the problem. The first time I saw about this, you know, so-called hadith, whether this is really from Amir al-Mu'mineen or not, the suspicion started when I looked at one of the speech of Murtaza Mutahiri, where he says, no, this is actually a statement by somebody who believes in relativity of moral values. That the values would change from one generation to another, one time to another, so do not impose your own values on your next generation. Because they have been created for a time different than your own time. And he said that, according to his research, this is not found in any of the Shia books. Now he gave this speech at a time when we didn't even have these computer softwares of Islamic data. When I looked at that statement, I said, let me, you know, now that we have a very powerful software of hadith of the Shias, all the books on the Shia hadith are there in one software with very good, you know, search capability. I said, let me try and look for this. And I searched all different wordings. What was amazing that I could not see this so-called hadith in the four main collections of hadith of the Shias. It's not there in Usul al-Kafi. It's not there in Man la yahzuruhu al-faqih. It's not there in Istibsar. And it's not even there in Tahzib. Not only these four books of the early days after Ghaybat al-Sughra, even the later days collections, books like Bihar al-Anwar, of Allah al-Majlisi, 110 volumes. He actually tried to compile everything, whether it's authentic or not, so that scholars who would come later on, they would have something to work on. Even in that 110 volumes of Bihar al-Anwar, this statement is not there. So this so-called hadith of Ali saying that, do not, you know, compel your children with the adab and customs of your own time, because they have been created for a different time. This is not to be seen in not even a single source of hadith of the Shia Ismailis. You know where I saw it? I saw it actually in the last volume, 20th volume of the commentary of Nahyu Balagha by Ibn Abil Hadid al-Mu'tazili, who is a Sunni scholar. And there also what he does at the end when he finished commenting on the sermons of Ali and the letters of Ali and the sayings of Ali, at the end he ends the commentary and then he starts a new chapter at the end of his last volume. And this last chapter is basically like an addendum, tatimma of the book. And in there I saw this statement. But even in that addendum, Ibn Abi al-Hadid al-Mu'tazili has a disclaimer before it. What he says, this is a section where I'm writing the sayings which Sayyid Razi did not include in Nahj al-Balagha. And he says, you know, some of those are known to be Ali's saying, some of them are not known. And then he says, وَبَعْضُهُ مِنْ كَلَامِ غَيْرِهِ مِنَ الْحُكَمَاءِ. And some of the sayings that I have in this section of the book is the sayings of some of the wise men of human history. وَلَكِنَّهُ كَالنَّظِيرُ لِكَلَامِهِ. But because those sayings are similar like the sayings of Ali, I have included it here. So you have a disclaimer that this is not the saying of Ali. And later on when I was doing research for something else, I found out that this statement, that do not compel your children with your own customs and adab or akhlaq, because they have been created for a different time, actually comes not from Amir al-Mu'mineen. It comes from an ancient Greek philosopher, Socrates, Socrates. And so if you hear it again from member, people trying to promote this idea of what I call fourth generation gap, that the parents are being told, do not pass on your values, your cultural values to the next generation because they have been created for a different time, whoever says, politely ask them, go and do your research. This is not a saying of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam al-Muttaqeen, Ali bin Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. I don't think Islam talks about this issue of rebelling necessarily against the traditions, unless there is fundamental flaw and something wrong in the tradition, as far as Islamic values are concerned. Because we believe in this issue of, you know, making changes, but based on informed decision. There was no generation gap when it came to Karbala. You know, from tonight we are going to start the zikr of the Shuhada of Banu Hashim. But before that, let me just give you one example of what I believe that these values have to continue from one generation to another. And the example we see is in Karbala. I mentioned the name of Muslim bin Awsajah last night. We are not sure about the name of the child or whether this is Muslim bin Awsajah's child, but there was a Sahabi who had been killed on that day. And soon after his shahadat, historians say to us that a child, early teens, in his early teens, comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam with a sword in his waistband. And Imam looked at it and Imam realized that this is the son of the Sahabi who was just killed. And he was here with his parents. When he came to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and he said, I want permission to go and fight for you. Imam looked at his young age, especially remembering that his father was just killed. Imam was concerned for the mother and he says, probably your mother would like to preserve you as a legacy of your father, as a sign of your father. You know what he says? He says, oh Imam, this sword that you see on my waistband here has been put by my mother. She is the one who has asked me to come and ask you for the permission of jihad. This is how we see the values going from one generation to another. It's not that she had to sit down and give a long lecture about shahadat and this and that. No. It was there, spontaneous, where the mother had raised this child in such a way that when the time comes to sacrifice the way your father has done, you should have this willingness right away. Imam prayed, did dua khair for this mother. And then look at this young boy, he goes there. The way he introduces, he says, Amiri Hussein wa ni'm al-amiri. My amir and the master is Hussein, and he's the best of masters. Fawadu Bashirin sururu fawadi Bashirin nadiri. This Hussein is actually the delight of the heart of the Prophet. A young boy, how much could he fight? He was killed. And this mal'oon killer, the murderer, he saw that the mother is standing by the tent looking at the jihad of the son. He actually severs the head of this boy and then out of his own level of cruelty, he threw it towards the mother. What did she do? She picked up the head, kissed the forehead of her own son. And then she threw the head back towards the body and saying, what I have given in charity for the sake of Hussein of Allah, I don't take it back. This is the level of, you know, sacrifice and qurbani that we are talking about. These are the values which has to be imparted from one generation to another till the day of Qiyamah. Hazrat Alana Hussain, yeh toh jazba us khatoon ka tha, jo ashab-e-Hussain ke khawateen mein se thi. اسی سے آپ اندازہ لگا سکتے ہیں کہ بنو ہاشم کے خواتین میں کیا جذبہ تھا. زینب کے اس جذبے قربانی کو آپ دیکھیں. وہ عبداللہ بن جعفر کی زوجہ ہیں, ان کا گھر الگ تھا مدینہ میں, لیکن جب خبر ملی کہ بھائی مدینہ چھوڑ رہے ہیں, زینب نے شوہر سے اجازت لی کہ مجھے اجازت چاہیے بھائی کے ساتھ جانا ہے. گھر چھوڑا, وطن چھوڑا بھائی کے خاطر, مدینہ جاتی ہیں, مکہ جاتی ہیں ساتھ. مکہ سے کربلا پہنچتی ہیں, شب عاشور جب یقین ہو گئی, یقین ہو جاتا ہے کہ کل جو ہے قربانی اور شہادت کا دن ہے, اس وقت زینب کے سامنے امتحان یہ ہے کہ ایک طرف میرا بھائی ہے, میرا امام وقت ہے اور اس کی اولاد ہے, دوسری طرف میری اولاد. زینب کا یہ ارادہ تھا کہ ہم اپنی اولاد کو حسین کے اولاد کے خاطر قربان کریں گے. رات بھر نصیحت کرتی رہی کہ بیٹا مجھے شرمندہ مت کرنا, یہ نہ ہو کہ حسین کے بچے شہید ہو جائیں اور تم زندہ رہو. صبح عاشور یہ دونوں بچے اصحاب کی شہادت کے بعد جب جاتے ہیں ماموں کے پاس اور اس نے جہاد مانگتے ہیں, امام انکار کرتے ہیں. بار بار یہ جب پلٹ کے آتے ہیں, زینب کہتی ہیں اونو محمد تمہیں کیا ہو گیا ہے, تم انتظار میں ہو کہ قاسم شہید کیے جائیں, اکبر شہید کیے جائیں, پھر جاؤ گے. آخر میں دونوں بچے کہتے ہیں کہ اے مادر گرامی ہمیں ماموں اجازت نہیں دیکھتے ہیں. آخر میں ماں آتی ہے اور امام سے اپنے اولاد کی قربانی کے لیے اجازت لیتی ہے. اللہ نے حسین دونوں یہ نوجوان ایک ساتھ جاتے ہیں لڑنے کے لیے. لڑتے لڑتے عمر سعد کے خیمے کے قریب تک پہنچ جاتے ہیں. ایک مرتبہ وہ ملعون اعلان کرتا ہے کہ دیکھو انہیں معمولی بچے مت سمجھو, یہ حیدر کرار کے نواسے اور جعفر طیار کے پوتے ہیں. جب تک یہ ساتھ رہیں گے تمہارا یہ کچھ تم ان کا کچھ نہیں بگاڑ سکتے ہو. بس ایک گھوڑا سوار دستہ تیزی سے آتا ہے اور ان کو محمد سے جدا کرتا ہے اور محمد کو ان سے جدا کرتا ہے. دونوں کو اپنے نرغے میں لے لیتے ہیں. اس طرح سے حملہ ہوتا ہے. ایک مرتبہ محمد کی آواز آتی ہے بھائی کے لیے اور ان کی آواز محمد کے لیے آتی ہے. ان آواز کا سننا تھا. حسین اٹھتے ہیں, حسین کے ساتھ عباس بھی اٹھتے ہیں. دونوں آتے ہیں لیکن جب پہنچے ہیں دیکھتے ہیں کہ دونوں بچوں کی روح جو ہے ملالہ کی طرز پرواز کر چکی تھی. دونوں لاش کو لا کے خیمے کے سامنے رکھا جاتا ہے. بزرگوں کے روایات کے مطابق زینب روئی نہیں ہے, اس لیے کہ جو اللہ کی راہ میں دے دیا جاتا ہے اسے واپس نہیں لیا جاتا ہے, اس پر افسوس بھی نہیں کیا جاتا ہے. بتانے والے یہ بھی بتاتے ہیں کہ دربار شام میں جب رہائی ملی ہے اور جب پہلی بار مجلس ہوئی ہے, بنو ہاشم کے سروں کو لایا گیا, بنو ہاشم کے ہر خاتون نے اپنے والی وارث کے سر کو لیا اور بیان کرنا شروع کیا. آخر میں دو سر نظر آئے. شام کی عورتوں نے کہا لگتا ہے یہ دونوں بچے یتیم تھے, ان کا کوئی نہیں ہے. بس یہ سننا تھا. زینب کہتی ہے ان بچوں کو یتیم مت سمجھو, یہ ماں زندہ ہے. لیکن ماں نے اپنے غم کو حسین کے لیے وقف کر دیا. ماتم حسین